It's my pleasure to be in the chair tonight. I'm standing in for our president, Stuart Ritchie, who's en route to Mumbai for the 10th annual Global Actuarial Conference. This is an extra meeting, not one of the original scheduled meetings, but it's an extra meeting to allow discussion of the work of the SAPS group within the CMI and the two working papers, one of which is on the title behind. This is in preparation for consultation closing at the end of this month. So because it's an extra meeting, because Stuart's not here, there aren't any of the usual preliminaries, save to remind you that those of you who want today to count for CPD need to have filled in one of the sheets at the front, and they'll be there at the end if, in the event that you've forgotten it. So that's one bit of housekeeping. The other is that tonight's proceedings will be the subject of an MP3, whatever that is, recording, and will be published afterwards. There are few sites more likely to set the pulse of the red-blooded actuary racing than that of a well-formed P-spline. And tonight we have the pleasure of three distinguished speakers from the CMI, volunteers from the CMI, Nigel Bodie on my right, Andrew Gash to my immediate right, and John Ellum. I'll just say a few words, if I may, by way of introduction, but they are eminent in their field. Nigel, having been with Watson Wyatt for 30 years, jumped ship last year, a year ago, to join PwC's pensions practice, and over his career he's been involved not only in mortality but also the wider scheme actuary work, including to a number of FTSE 100 companies, so a practicing actuary. Andrew has been on the CMI working group since 1903.
Since
2003. And it says here that he's contributed CMI working papers 4, 9, 17, 29, 31, and 32, but he didn't say what the bonus ball was. In his day job, he's been with Aon Consulting since 1995, looking after a range of pension schemes from the quite small to the very large, and now leads Aon's mortality advisory group. Finally, on my left, John Ellum, with an insurance background, having worked most of his career at Standard Life, and having retired in the summer last year, has been involved in some of the other series, not the SAPS table, but some of the other mortality series that you know well. And John was also part of the group that presented the prize-winning two-dimensional mortality paper to the faculty last year. So three eminent speakers. There will be two presentations. Nigel's going to say a few words of introduction, then Andrew's going to do a presentation, then John's going to do a shorter presentation, and then we'll throw the floor open to questions. So with that, Nigel, welcome, over to you.
Right, thank you very much, Romy. It's a pleasure to be up here. There's the agenda, and just a few remarks. Then Andrew will talk about the main comments and issues that we would like responses on in terms of the questions that we posed in the graduations paper. And then John will be talking about what we are going to be doing in the next year. Brian Wilson is chairman of the SAPS committee. He can't be with us tonight, unfortunately. But bearing in mind that we are talking about mortality, the committee decided to send the oldest member of the committee to talk to you while they still had the opportunity. Now, a couple of areas that we would prefer probably not to discuss this time, partly because they were not things that we were intended to report on in the first place. That is that there was criticism in the press that we had not talked about rates of mortality improvement. Now, we do have a very substantial volume of data. We have 10 million years in the exposed to risk, but it's over a very short time span. The CMI insured investigations have smaller volumes of data, but they extend over a very long period of time. We are not in a situation to be able to do projections, but John will talk about what we can do at the moment. We also have considerable heterogeneity of data. We have something like 380 sets of data have been submitted to us, but only about 30 schemes have two successive valuations in the data that we have. So we're looking for a lot more data to come in such that we can expand that, but the findings that we've come up with are subject to some of that heterogeneity that I mentioned. Now, one of the parts in the build-up to this was to comment on how we think the SAPS tables might be used. 3 points. We think, first of all, they're the most up-to-date tables. Secondly, they have a significantly different shape to the existing OO series, and in particular the 92 series. Figures 42 to 51 in the paper show comparisons with the rates. We are now beginning to see the larger or largest pension schemes subdividing their data into low and high paid, so that we're seeing different mortality assumptions for different categories of people, partly arising from the earlier work that the committee carried out. So we think that we have now got additional tables that will allow scheme actuaries more choice in the assumptions they adopt, even for the largest schemes where an element of self-rating is always possible. Thirdly, for the smaller schemes that don't have a credible experience, we think that by publishing three sets of tables, the all lives, the normal, the all lives, the heavy and the light mortality, we are giving scheme actuaries a choice again that if their scheme that they're valuing, which does not have credible data, is particularly biased towards blue collar or white collar workers, for example, we have tables that they may find helpful in valuing those schemes. I'd like to thank John, who'll be talking to you later. He joined us with the experience of producing some of the tables in the OO series graduations, and we valued his assistance very much in producing these tables. One more vote of thanks. No self-respecting set of mortality tables would be complete without a contribution from David Wilkie, and he has done a considerable amount for us, and also the CMI Secretariat have done an enormous amount of the groundwork to produce the papers, and there will be plenty more to come. Clearly, with all these helpers, any errors that are in the paper are the committee's. And talking of errors, there is one. Figure 46, I'm going to have to read this because it's a bit technical. Figure 46 on page 38 is incorrect as it compares female pensioner amounts light with PCFL00 and not female pensioner lives as stated. The correct table is available from the CMI part of the professions website. This highlights one of the questions that we have asked. Does anyone have any better suggestions for heavy and light, as the use of L is potentially ambiguous and could lead to mistakes, and in fact already has? So with no further ado, actually I will just mention one point. We are looking for names for these heavy and light tables. I should say that the very enjoyable dinner after the presentation that we gave last week, I'm afraid it degenerated rather, and one suggestion ultimately made was toffs and proles. On the assumption that we will be able to edit that out of the transcript here, I'll now ask Andrew to talk through the graduations themselves.
Thank you, Nigel. I'll start with a brief recap of the work of the CMI SAPS committee to date. There have been a number of previous working papers, and these have focused on either containing a summary or an analysis of the underlying data up to various dates. Working paper 31 was published at the same time as these proposed graduations, contained in working paper 32, and contains a summary of the data underlying these graduations. Any feedback on this working paper is very welcome, and in particular, in response to the various questions that are raised directly, and should be sent to Simon Spencer at the CMI, or emailed to newtables@cmib.org.uk by 29th of February. So as Nigel has already mentioned, the size of the data set is now large. We have around 200,000 deaths for males and around 150,000 for females, and that's around three times the size of the data set for the 00 series pensioner tables. It's also worth being clear how the data set or the data sets are divided for the SAPS tables. Some schemes are able to differentiate between pensioners who have retired in normal health and those who have retired in ill health, and that provides the first two categories of normal health and ill health data. On the other hand, some schemes are unable to differentiate between members who have retired under normal health and ill health, and that provides the combined data. The final fourth group is for dependents, and we have not used any data for members with unknown status, i.e. those who cannot be divided between pensioners and dependents. This next slide shows the numbers of deaths subdivided by year and highlights one of the key differences between the collection methods for the Life Office 00 series data and the SAPS data. The former collects data after the end of each calendar year for that calendar year, hence the 00 series were based essentially on four calendar years of full data. In contrast, the SAP study collects data from scheme actuaries when available, which typically means data arrives in three-year chunks as part of a triennial valuation process. So we do not receive full data for any calendar year until at least 3 years after the end of that calendar year. And that results in the pattern that you can see here, with the most data for 2002 and 2003, and progressively less data for 2004 and onwards. There were a large number of potential tables that were considered, and these included lives tables and amounts tables for males and females. We had four different data types, pensioners, that being all pensioners, excluding dependents, which included normal health retirements, ill health retirements, and the combined data set. Secondly, we had normal health pensioners, third, ill health pensioners, and finally, the dependents set. We also had three variants on based on pension size, as shown in the second column. The first variant contains data for all pension sizes. The second contained data for broadly those lives receiving the top 25% of pensions by amount, and we've termed them light. And the third containing the remaining 75% of pensioners by size, which we have termed heavy. So those 40 possible tables were actually cut down to 20 tables for the consultation, as shown in the table on the screen, and we suspect that may still be more than practitioners want to use. So one of the questions we've asked is, are there some tables that should be cut out from the final set? And in particular, we've highlighted in red a few which may be less useful. There are four specific questions in the working paper on the tables. Firstly, abbreviations for light and heavy. Do you have a better idea? Secondly, the light tables are currently based on the top 25% of pension amounts. We could base them on the top 12.5% of the data. Would that be a preferred method? Or indeed, would you like us to consider that more fully and embark on further consultation? Thirdly, a suggestion on which table should be retained. And finally, on the table name abbreviations in general. So a brief overview of the method to produce the graduations. To begin with, the data for each proposed table was graduated across a central range of ages, and this was picking up the range of ages where the committee felt that there was sufficient data to do so. The graduations used Gompertz-Makem type formulas with polynomials of orders R and S. The approach that was taken is for the graduations is similar to that for the 00 series tables, and further details can be found in the paper by Forfar, McCutcheon and Wilkie from 1988. The graduated tables were then extended to higher ages and lower ages, and I'll explain some of the details there later. Any anomalies between the tables were removed. For example, the mu x's for normal retirements were at some ages higher than the mu x's for all pensioners, and the methods that we removed such anomalies are set out in the paper again. Finally, the mu x's were converted to q x's using the same approach as for the 00 tables. So moving on to the extensions to high ages, we began with the graduated values, which we took up to age 95. Mu at age 121 was set to a sufficiently high value, so QX at 120 would equal 1 to a sufficient number of decimal places. And between 105 and 120, we have set mu such that QX will equal 0.45 for males and equal 0.4 for females. And this is an approach based on relatively recent work published by the ONS on population data in England and Wales. And there's a reference to the particular piece of work in the working paper. So then between ages 95 and 105, we fitted values using blended values that match the mu at age 95 and the mu at age 105. The detail of the blending approach is in the paper again. And this overall approach is similar to that used for double zero tables. However, a key difference is that the 00 series tables blended to a mu of 1 at age 120, whereas we have blended to this other mu at age 105 as described. In practical terms, there's little difference in resulting annuities up to age 80, at any rate. And one of the questions we ask in the working paper is for feedback on this method that we have used for extending the tables to the higher ages. Now, getting rather more complex, the extensions to lower ages, there's a summary shown here. And I'll take each of the graduation types in turn. The pensioners' data was graduated over the range 55 to 95, and the graduation was extended down to age 50 only. If it were extended to pensioners at younger ages, which would be ill health cases, then the resulting curve would probably need to take a U-shaped characteristic. And we have not taken that approach. We've extended the table down only to age 50. And in view of the small extension, the graduation formula has been used from ages 50 and upwards. The normal health pensioners were again graduated over the range 55 to 95. And we noted after doing the graduations that there was data present below age 50, which suggested some form of misclassifications. And given that any misclassifications were unlikely to be restricted only to below age 50, we have had some doubts over data up to perhaps around age 60. And for that reason, we have used graduated values from ages 60 and above. The normal health tables have then been extended down to age 20 by adopting a blend of various 00 series assured lives tables such that the value at 60 or just below and just above 60 match. The ill health tables were graduated over the range 35 to 95, and the graduation formula resulted in a slightly U-shaped curve with a minimum value for mu x occurring at around age 41 for males and 42 for females. So the approach we've taken is simply to take that minimum value and extend that to the younger ages down to age 20. Finally, the dependents were graduated over the range 45 to 95. They were extended to age 20, where they were set somewhat arbitrarily to match the assured lives smoker, non-smoker, and the average of those two for the widows, heavy, light, and all table, respectively. We also set the formulas to extend the table so that it matched the value at age 45, and it matched the slope of the curve at age 45, and then a GM formula of 0-3 order was used to fit those three data points. Now, having described the approach we've taken, we do recognise there are alternatives that could have been taken. For example, it would have been possible to graduate the pensioners, the all pensioners, down to age 20, if it were accepted that a U-shaped curve was appropriate, and such a table may be useful for an all-pension evaluation where ill health was not differentiated. Similarly, the normal health table could have been curtailed at age 50 and then used in conjunction with the ill health pensioner table to form a pair of tables where ill health is differentiated. So in view of the number of different alternatives that could be taken, we've asked four questions in the paper for feedback. The first is whether the tables should be graduated down to the age of 20, or indeed which tables should be graduated down to a lower age. Secondly, whether where tables are extended, 20 is the right age, or whether 16 or 17 or some other age is more appropriate. Thirdly, in particular for the all pensioners table, whether that should be graduated below age 50. And finally, whether the methods we have used to extend to low ages are deemed to be appropriate. Now, in general, the committee was satisfied with the fit of the graduations over the range where they were graduated. And figures 1 to 20 in the working paper show graphs similar to this one, showing the effect of the graduation. And you have in black the graduated mu, and it shows a good fit over the central range, 55 to 95. The graph also shows the crude mu values, which are the blue dots. It shows the green low gates and the red high gates. Those are showing the 2.5% and the 97.5% percentiles at each age. Figures 21 to 29 in the working paper demonstrate our rationale for retaining or not retaining certain tables, and I'll outline a few of these briefly. So this is figure 21, which shows for males all pensioners and normal health pensioners on an amount and on a lives basis. And the committee concluded that perhaps only one table need be retained for lives, and in that case we retain for all excluding dependents pensioners lives table. And on the amounts basis we have retained both the all pensioners and the normal health pensioners table for the consultation. Looking at the male all pensioner amounts table in figure 23, this shows the heavy, the all and the light graduations, and the committee concluded that all should be retained due to the distinct differences. However, one question we have asked is whether if we are producing tables for heavy, all and light for normal health, whether we also need tables for heavy, all and light for all pensioners. For females, figure 26 refers again, this shows heavy, all and light graduations. It can be seen that the differences between the three graduations are somewhat less than those seen for males. However, we have retained all three graduations. For widows, again, we can see the graduations for heavy, all and light, and it can be noted that there is a bigger distinction between these three graduations than there is for any of the other female graduations. And again, all three tables have been retained for the consultation. The high and low age adjustments are demonstrated in figures 30 to 41 in the working paper. And I'll briefly review the effect of the low age adjustments described previously for two of the tables. So this is figure 31. And it demonstrates the difficulty of extending the male all pensioner table so that it is applicable for all pensioners at any age. Below age 50, it would reflect ill health retirement only. And you can see that there's a higher rate of mortality for the ill health retirements shown in green on the slide. So it would probably be necessary to either have a discontinuity somewhere between ages 50 or 60, or to blend the tables, say, between 50 and 65, which would probably result in a U-shaped curve, obviously depending a bit on how the smoothing was done. Now, the appropriate approach and the resulting blend would vary possibly significantly from scheme to scheme. So to date, we have been minded only to graduate this table to age 50. And this same issue occurs for females, shown in figure 36 of the working paper. Figure 37 demonstrates the extensions to young ages for male ill healths. And you can see here how the value of mu x at age 42 has been continued down to younger ages. We now move on to some observations on the proposed tables. And the key feature throughout the SAP studies has been the heavier mortality experience than that observed for life office pensioner studies. And the following three charts show a comparison of the proposed SAP's light tables, which are shown in red, and a comparative 00 series table shown in green. The 00 series table has been projected to 2003 using medium cohort projections, so it's from a comparable calendar year. Now, the choice of medium cohort projection for this purpose is entirely arbitrary, and we don't want to imply that it's a suitable projection for any particular purpose. We mentioned earlier that the light tables contain data for around the top 25% of lives, and that it would be possible to produce an alternative table based on the top 12.5% of pensions by size. And the chart and the graduation that would result is shown also on this chart in blue. So it can be seen that the proposed light pensioner table for males in red is heavier than the comparative 00 series table in green from around ages 70 and upwards. And the alternative top graduation table in blue is lighter than the comparative 00 series table from up to age 80, but it's heavier thereafter. This chart shows the corresponding picture for females. Now, as expected, the top band graduation in blue is slightly lighter than the proposed light graduation, that's the top 25% graduation shown in red. However, there's a difference when you compare it to the 00 series table, and that is that both the light and the top band tables are lighter across the whole age range, apart from the very top, than the 00 series tables. Finally, for widows, the picture is perhaps more similar to that for male pensioners. So the proposed light table in red is heavier than the comparative 00 series table in green from age 70 upwards. The comparative top band graduation in blue is lighter than the comparative 00 series table up to age 75, but heavier thereafter. Now, I know that these charts are somewhat difficult to read on the screen because the lines are quite close together, but in conclusion, I think what these three charts show is that the proposed SAPS graduations, even the light tables, are in general heavier than the comparative 00 series tables projected to 2003, and adopting the top band rather than the light tables would shift that position somewhat, but in many cases, the comparative 00 series tables would remain lighter than the SAPS tables. Finally, these last three slides compare the expectations of life at age 65, and there are further comparisons in Appendix B of Working Paper 32. So this is a comparison for males, and it demonstrates that there is a difference of around 2.5 years of life expectancy between the heavy and light pensioners, being the first and the third bars from the top, with the alternative top band pensioners being, which is the fourth band down, being around half a year longer in life expectancy again. The expectation of life for the comparative projected AA series table, which is the bottom bar, is between that for the light and the heavy table. However, that pattern probably varies by age. The expectation of life for the normal table is very similar to that for the all pensioner table. That's the normal pensioner table in green, the all pensioner table in black. There's only around 0.1 years difference. And finally, the ill health expectation of life is noticeably shorter at around 3 years. That's illustrated in red, shorter than that for normal health. A comparable graph for females demonstrates a smaller difference in life expectancy as you look at the variations by pension size, with a difference of just over 1 year between the heavy and light, that's the first and third bars, with the alternative top band bar, that being the fourth bar from the top, being only about a quarter of a year longer life expectancy. And the comparative life expectancy from the AA series, shown in the bottom bar, exceeds that for both the light and the top band pensioners. Again, the expectation of life for normal health pensioners is around 0.1 years longer than that for all pensioners, so similar at age 65. And the comparative life expectancy for ill health pensioners is significantly shorter, around 2 years less than that for normal health. Finally, for widows, this demonstrates significant difference by pension size as for males, with a difference of around 2.5 years between the heavy and light pensioners, being the first bar from the top and the third bar, with the alternative top band pensioners, the fourth bar being around half a year longer than the light pensioners. Again, there's the comparison against the 00 series, the bottom bar, which shows that the life expectancy under the 00 series exceeds that under either the light or the top band widows proposed tables. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. It says here what I'm going to talk about very briefly are the future investigations of the SAPS committee. Really talking about the work that they would like to do this year, 2008, and really falling into these three categories: analysis of further data submissions, looking for some evidence of patterns of improvement, and industrial classifications. If I could say something about the analysis of further data submissions, I think the SAPS committee, when it started, thought they were going to do a finite piece of work. They would wind up having done something, that would be all it. But it's not been really like that. And now they've got the bit between the teeth. They've seen there's an awful lot of stuff they can do. But to do all this, they actually need data. They need more data. So it's a plea from the SAPS committee to all the consultants out there: please keep sending in your data. Please keep sending it in on time, as quickly as you can. I'm told that after the last working paper, I had an earlier working paper, you stopped. I can say you because it's not me. You stopped, and when a request was sent for more data with a deadline of the end of February 2007, it all piled up on the 28th of February 2007. That's quite good, over 100 schemes coming in on that date. But still, that does create an awful lot of work for the CMI Secretariat, so it would actually be better if it came as you do the valuations. A little about improvements. Nigel said in the introduction that the data that we were getting here is not suitable for projecting future improvements, but it is suitable, or will be suitable, if we get more of it, to see some patterns of improvements in the past. It's a very short past, but it will be suitable to see some of that, and shortly I'll show you a little of that that is already there. The third thing, industrial classifications. The analysis to date has been done broadly on high annuities and low annuities. That simple split as being a, shall we say, a proxy for socioeconomic group, maybe a proxy for industrial or type of work or type of workers. But the data is there to actually do analysis by large industrial groups, as we'll see shortly. You'll remember that the data that we've got for this is for the calendar years 2000 to 2006. It's valuations that have been done over the period probably up to mid-2007, maybe. But it's data effectively up to 2006, clustered very heavily in the middle. So we don't really have a long trend analysis that we can do for improvements. And the other point that Nigel mentioned, to reiterate this, only a few schemes have submitted data twice. So we don't actually have the ongoing longitudinal picture that is available in the CMI Life Office data. They're sending in data every year, and you are actually seeing the same population year after year after year. The data that's on the CMI website, and a lot of data has been published on the CMI website, does show improvements against short cohort. 92 series short cohort. This is not meant to suggest that short cohort is the right answer at all. Similarly, medium cohort is not necessarily the right answer either. It's just a convenient tool to use. And at the time this work was being done, there's very little difference between short cohort and medium cohort, or even long cohort projections over the period 2000 to 2006. It's not a great deal of difference. This is a reminder, if you like, of the data that we've seen coming in, how it's peaked in 2002, a little less in 2003, and then tailing off. And the left-hand axis, as you'll see, is A over E against PMA92 short cohort. So this was work that was done prior to graduating the tables, producing the graduated tables that we have in working paper 32. And you can see from this that the A over E's are very heavy relative to PMA92 for SAPs business, for all retirements, all amounts. And if you see the age bands, the wavy lines at the top of this screen for the different age bands, they're more or less horizontal. I say more or less. They're not showing any definite trend. They are showing that mortality at the younger ages is much heavier than life officers, and at the older ages, the really old ages, is getting down to sort of the level of life officers. But in general, it looks quite a bit heavier. But it also looks like the cohort projection might give the right sort of answer, or given the right sort of answer to date. But if we then look at this one, which is normal retirements, as opposed to early retirements, ill health retirements, or any other type of retirement, we can see that for the younger ages, we're getting a significant improvement, albeit there's not much data in 2006, but a significant improvement against short cohort improvements. So, is short cohort enough for SAPS schemes? I know there have been discussions elsewhere. There was a discussion last year at the Institute on the need to have a minimum level of improvement, and all this work has been done just using the straight cohort improvements. There's no mention of minimums or anything like that in this. So there's plenty of scope to actually see from this data where improvements might have gone, but there's not going to be enough probably to see where it's going to go yet. And finally, as you can see here, this is an analysis of the number of deaths over the period 2000 to 2006 by industrial category. Now, some of these industrial categories could well be big enough to justify a graduation on their own, or analysis on their own. And that is the intention of the SAPS group this year to look at that, to look at variations between classifications, or even maybe for some of these actually within classifications, because industrials could cover a multitude of companies, consumer goods similarly. So it may well be scoped to look at within there and produce results, maybe not graduations, but results for each of several different classifications. That really is the end of the presentation. Now is a time for discussion, and there are a few points we've got here that Andrew probably mentioned a lot of these in his way through. Nigel mentioned a few of them as well. The sorts of things that we really need feedback on. I say we really need feedback, as Andrew has said, by the 29th of February, a leap year this year, an extra day. But you can send it in sooner. That'd be very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So the floor is open, as always, and please could you come to one of the microphones either down the middle or on the outside, and say who you are before you make your contribution. In addition, Nigel, to the questions that are there, you're also interested to hear from the audience what use people will put these tables to, and in so doing, if people feel able to give some comments on that, that'll also inform additional work that could usefully be done, if not this year, then at some future stage. So you can get your requests in as part of the discussion here. So the floor is open.
That work? Yes. Name's David Wilkie, and I spoke last week at the Institute and said a number of things there, and I shan't repeat them now. But in this evening's presentation, there were one or two things that crossed my mind that seemed worthwhile asking questions about or commenting on. It seems to me one of the questions that was asked was, do you want lots of tables? It doesn't seem to me any harm in publishing lots of tables. Nobody needs to use them. They can be totally forgotten about if people want to forget about them, don't need them. But there's no harm in leaving them in the paper. One's only using a bit of extra paper and a bit of extra space for it, so long as it's not too much extra work to the committee. But since I've done a lot of them, there's no point in missing them out. A small technical point on that one, which I think it'd be helpful to be clarified exactly. For the low ages ill health, you said that the minimum value was about age 41 for males and 42 for females, and you had below those ages you had used something. Now, was it actually the minimum value, if you discovered it exactly, or was it mu 41 or mu 42 exactly, which wouldn't be very far away, it's just useful to know which. As regards going down to young ages, I mean, practitioners will know what you need, but I wouldn't think there's any difficulty in going down to age 17 rather than age 20. Quite a lot of the CMI tables in the past did go down to age 17. Conceivably, you would have an ill health pensioner or a widow of 17 or 18, and it's slightly awkward to find that you've got somebody of 17 and haven't got a table. There's no entry in the table for it, so what do you do? One thing just on that very last, or not quite the last slide, but the last graph that seemed interesting, there was considerable improvement in the normal retirements at young retired ages. Now, I think it'd be interesting to see the same graphs for ill health retirements, because I was wondering whether what might be happening is many more people retiring early on not very ill health, but nevertheless slightly poorer mortality. And if they retire early, you get the curious position that the normal retirements improve because they're the super fit, and the ill health retirements also improve because they're the real ill health retirements plus some others that are, I won't say skiving, that sounds a bit too strong, but just feel that their work is done and early retirement would be appropriate. What would be interesting to look at is the proportions of normal and ill health retirements. If the ill health retirements have gone up substantially in the most recent years, possibly because there are just different schemes coming in those most recent years, then that might account for that sort of shift. That's the sort of thing I think one might want to look at. And it's therefore important also to look at the aggregate mortality, but even that's a bit confused because there are plenty of people still at work and they're part of the aggregate mortality as well. The aggregate shouldn't have changed too much, but again, it could be that the super fit stay on working and the slightly tireder people retire early. So the pensioners get worse is what I would suggest there, if that's happening. Or it might be the other way around, that the workers, the people still at work in 60 to 65 or 55 to 65 are slightly less. Sorry, they include more of the marginally healthy people. I'm getting this the wrong way around. Anyway, you see the point, that it could be fractions of ill health, or I can't quite explain it, but it's the fractions of ill health and normal retirements that might make a difference. I hope that's given some people the opportunity of thinking about what they want to say too.
Good evening, it's Martin Potter. I've got two questions, if I may. I was interested in the extension to higher ages, because I've sometimes heard it said about mortality studies for pension schemes that it's better to have a good fit where the bulk of your data lies, and one might expect that to be in the ages sort of in the 60s and the 70s, whereas in reality, when we're interested in expectation of life and annuities, the age range 85 to 95 is of more interest. So a question for the panel was just a few comments on the level of data that they found in the 85 to 95 age range, and perhaps sort of some comments on what might have been the state of the development of occupational pension schemes when those people were actually active members. And the second question was, it was pleasing to note as an actuary with clients in this with pension schemes that the mortality tables that you've drawn up for us are heavier than the zero tables, and I wonder if you had any insights for us on why that might be the case. Thank you.
If I just comment first of all on the amount of data at ages 85 to 95, I don't have any particular statistic that I can give you, but there are two things that I'd point to. The first is, if you're really interested in the amount of data, then Working Paper 31 should provide some information on that. And the other thing that may be quite helpful to look at is the figures, I think it was 21 onwards, the ones which have the green and red dots showing the sort of 2.5 and 97.5 percentiles. And broadly, if the percentiles are very close together, then we're fairly sure what the data's saying. So if they remain fairly close together over the range up to 95, which I think they do, which is why we were happy to graduate up to that age, that means that we're fairly confident that we've got enough data to be telling us what's happening. If they're wider apart, it means that we're having to we're having to select from a slightly wider range that the data would support. Now, in terms of why the SAPS tables may be observed to be heavier than the 00 series tables, I guess this comes back to the reason that the tables are heavier comes back to the data, and the earlier working papers, we've seen this effect in the data throughout, and there have been a number of suggestions of why it will be, the key one being it's probably a different kind of population underlying the data. So the pensioner tables for the 00 series may contain more smaller schemes, it may contain more higher earners, although actually the amounts of pension, the average amounts of pension, if you can get to that data, may or may not support that. But it's the comments I've heard is that it's generally viewed to be a sort of selective effect on the underlying population.
Can I ask a question? This was I invited the audience to say what it was they were going to use these for, and you asked the question, how many tables do we need? I mean, for the most part, I think what most pension scheme actuaries do with mortality tables is they stick an interest rate on it and discount it and come up with a value. And I wonder, I wasn't able to tell, and I was too lazy to do the work myself, the extent to which some of these tables that certainly on the slides looked very close together, to what extent, once you stick a discount rate on them, do they actually give you much difference in the value? Because I suspect that in the real world, if they don't give you much difference in the value, that then in practice actuaries will congregate, you know, one of these ones that tends to produce the same practical value will become more popular than others, perhaps because it's adopted by one or more of the major firms, and it then becomes the norm, and the others waste away. So I wondered if, you know, in that practical sense, whether there was, whether any of them, you know, whether there was really in practice that much difference between some of them. And the other thing that occurred to me was that again, it wasn't easy to tell from the charts. But I mean, one of the things you can do is you can just say, well, I'll take 90% of a table. You know, if my particular scheme isn't an exact match for this, but it's broadly the right shape, I take 90% of it, or I take 110% of it. And I wondered to what extent some of these tables could be pretty closely arrived at just by taking a proportion of one of the other tables. And if that were the case, if the shapes were sufficiently similar, it would seem to me that having a whole proliferation of them, when in fact you could get to them by an adaptation of one of them, didn't seem to make an awful lot of sense in a world in which the tables are growing faster than life expectancy.
Okay, I'll take that one on. Certainly, in terms of the difference between the heavy and light, we are looking at, as Andrew said, 2.5 years difference in expectation of life, which will translate into annuity values of 7 or 8% difference, and that would be distinctly noticeable if the heavy tables were to be more appropriate. And we also find the tables are heavier than the existing standard tables as well. So I think there's enough in there to interest the finance director at the very least, although I think at the same time we'd need to be quite careful. A consultant who said you can have the improvement in the mortality tables and knock the liabilities backwards might be criticised if at the same time he hadn't addressed the question of the allowance for future improvements as well. I think there'd be a bit of trading off one against the other would be appropriate. In terms of taking a percentage of another table, It would be nice if that were the case, because we did start off looking at this to see if there was some way of parameterizing the tables, such that you could just tweak a parameter and then say this was suitable for heavy light, etc. Unfortunately, it doesn't work, because we find once you get to about 1995, the tables have tended to converge, although not completely, whereas at ages 60 and so on, they are very far apart. One of the charts in Working Paper 31 shows that for the people age 65, the people in the highest amount of pension exhibit half the rate of mortality of the people in the lowest band of pension. So there's a very substantial difference at the younger ages, and they all come together at the older ages, suggesting it's luck and genetics how long you survive beyond a certain point. So the tables are a very different shape to each other, and so again, I'm afraid we may end up with the sight of actuaries stuck in the headlights, not quite knowing which set of tables they're going to choose, but they are all to some extent different, and I'm afraid scheme actuaries are going to have to make their minds up as to which is appropriate for their scheme. One of the things that we did at the Institute meeting last week was get some shows of hands about one or two of the things that we were consulting about and which we would value feedback. Before we get on to that, there was one part which may seem slightly obscure. I certainly wasn't entirely convinced about the first contribution that I heard, but after a while, when several other people picked up on it as well, I thought, well, maybe there is something here, and that is the naming convention for the tables. We're calling them essentially SAPS 03, and Dr. Pryor, who is on the Board of Actuarial Standards, said that the public perception is that if you publish a set of tables in 2008 that are actually labelled 03, they are 5 years out of date, and people have in the past said, how can it take the actuarial profession so long to produce something that's so out of date? They are not out of date, as we know, and the suggestion was made that perhaps we could call it something not time-related, such as Series 1 or Series 2, as we go through the various publications. Suggestions that they could be called XP and Vista were turned down. So I don't know whether anybody would care to comment on the naming convention, whether they think there is something in this that we ought to give it some not time-related name. And if there are any comments on that, please say now. Otherwise, we'll move on to some of the questions that were asked, on which we got a show of hands, and one or two results that we had not expected. Anybody want to call them Series 1 rather than the 03 tables? Or does nobody care? I see one vote for no care in front of me already. No special. Do we kowtow to the Board for Actuarial Standards and call it something else? No.
Well, okay. I guess I'd say, why, if the public, if there's that perception, what's the great advantage in calling them the O3 tables? Yes. I suppose it's the extent whether you name them to suit the actuaries or name them to suit the outside world.
It is a real concern. I've had clients asking the same question. I think perhaps you could call it the 07 or the 08 set of tables, because that's when you publish them.
A danger the other way round, from a was the PA90 tables that were based on the data from 1967 to 70, forecast in 1990, and everybody, at least they gave the impression that we're up to date in 1990, by which time we'd be totally overtaken by events. So don't call them 2020 tables. It'll be wrong.
Okay, so if we can touch on some of the questions for feedback. First of all, can we ask, would anyone be opposed to the publication of ill health tables, or do you think they are unnecessary? Anybody opposed to the use of ill health? That's exactly the response we got from the Institute. All against normal, do we require both sets of tables? In favour of both sets of tables? Nobody wants to throw data away. Against? Nope. Okay. We have very few lives tables here. The subdivision into amounts, particularly for the males, appears to explain quite a lot of lives variation. Are people content that we should just have the three tables that we have set out here? Anybody anxious for more lives tables, say now. So I think probably outvoted. Okay.
Well, can I ask why? Because I'm interested to know what people, to come back to the question, what do people do with the tables? Why? What's the advantage of having more lives tables?
If I could make a point about lives table, one is it actually goes back to the amounts table that we have a heavy and a light amounts table, and there's a certain element to me that means you're taking amounts into account twice. Is there any difference between a light lives table and a light amounts table, since it's only a quarter of the total experience element?
There's not very much difference. When we were doing the analysis, one of the things we looked at was how much variation there was within the subdivisions by amount bands. And where we found that there was a lot of variation, or the variation wasn't what we expected, we split the band down further. So that's the reason that we went from having four bands in some of the much older working papers to five bands, because there were some apparent inconsistencies, which once we split it out, things made much more sense. So in answer to the question, there wouldn't be a lot of difference, I wouldn't expect, between a light lives table and a light amounts table. Are we double counting? I don't think that we're coming up with answers that are wrong, but there's not a lot of difference between the two.
Okay, we'll take that point away with us. The bandings, the suggestion was floated that if we took, for example, the top band and put it in the top 12.5% rather than the top 25, we would be ending up with expectations of life that are close to the existing standard tables. And also, if we were to move to another, a different banding at the lower end, say take the bottom 50% instead of 75, the suggestion from at least one speaker at the Institute last week was that they would prefer to be able to interpolate between the two tables rather than just have two tables which encompass 100% of the data. So any comments from people? Would they prefer us to go to the top banding at 12.5 and a bottom banding at 50% of the data to allow a little bit of scope in between? Who would like a wider spread of the bands?
I think it's worth investigating. I would be inclined to look at the bottom 20, next 20, next 20, next 20. Well, you may have done some of that in the first place. Another approach is to use, as Charlie Keir will say, the sort of generalised linear model approach with another as a practice, which is a more elaborate investigation, but worth doing too.
Certainly when we were looking at the data, we started off with the males, the bottom 50%, but we did find that there were distinctly different characteristics for about the bottom 30 and the next 20. There was a noticeable difference in shape when we started prowling around deep in the data. So it's there are different subdivisions, but I'm not seeing a large number of people wanting a wider spread, which is exactly opposite to what the Institute said. They were very keen to have a much wider spread, and therefore I think the committee will take the line of least resistance and do nothing. Right. The extension of the tables to young ages. We can drop the tables down to 20 or 17. It's not a particular problem. Would people like us to extend the normal table down to a low age, even though we'd actually be using rates that could not possibly have any justification because there aren't any normal retirements below age 50, but purely in terms of, for example, system changes. I know one consultant said that if they didn't have a set of values down to age 20, their system would fall over. So not wanting to see actuaries falling over, then what would people like us to extend down as far as we can? In favour? Against? Oh, that's tricky. Right. Probably the favourite
those actuaries, the systems follower, are incapable of drawing a straight line from the lowest age that you've already got to 17, presumably.
Right. And any comments on the upper age approach? I'll let you know that one contribution last week suggested that the fact that we effectively force everybody into the same rate at 105 was inappropriate, and that in fact at advanced ages we still see differential rates of mortality. Have we gone too far in pressing everyone together? Should we extend the tables upwards further, even though the data would be actually quite difficult? The data tails over at the top ages, so we'd need to just extend the existing differential. And there are differentials, to be fair. The AFRE charts in Working Paper 31 do show a difference, even at age 95, between the bands. So should we, are we forcing people together at 105 incorrectly, or is that really not all that important? People like to see a bigger spread into a more advanced ages?
But they're in the same boat as last week.
Okay. I think that really covers, just make sure we've covered all the questions we were on. Yes, Chris.
Yes. Could you, I think people might be finding it difficult to hear. If you wanted to step out to the microphone in the middle and.
Hi there. Apologies if this has already been answered. But you noticed that the you can either split it into the top 12.5% or the top 25%. And I think the earlier example you used is that when you're varying between who's heavy and who's light, you could differentiate it as being the toffs and the pros. Now, it strikes me that actually in that sort of example, you've actually got, in terms of social structure, you've got upper class, you've got working class, and you've got middle class. So was there any reason why it was only two classes that were chosen rather than three? Or was it just for administrative simplicity? Or?
There was a degree of method in our madness here. When we looked in Working Paper 31 at the charts of the A over E's against the standard table, what we found was that the three bands that we put together into the heavy group were all noticeably above 100% A over E, and tended to follow pretty much the same pattern, heading down from values of 160-170% A over E at 65-60 down to about 120% at age 95. For the two highest paid bands, the lightest mortality, they started around 60-70% and gradually went upwards. So there was a very clear distinction between the three heaviest groups and the two lightest groups. So you could almost draw a line between them, and they were completely separate and almost mirror image. So that's why we picked those particular groupings, that they did appear to have similar characteristics between themselves and very different characteristics against the other one. But we'd certainly be prepared to look at a wider spread of those. But my own view is it does leave that gap in the middle, which I would think is not appropriate. And I'm not sure we'd have, we want a third set of tables along there. So as we've got all, which is not too bad a fit between all of them, but there was a reason why we'd subdivided the data in the way we did.
It just strikes me that obviously amount is a proxy to socioeconomic group, and given that a lot of quite rich people have lots of smaller pensions, I suspect that as you get down to the lower pension amounts, you may be having more of a mix between different socioeconomic groups, whereas when you get the higher pensions, you're pretty fairly certain there are people in the higher groups.
We certainly believe that is the case for females. There is the amount of pension is a very poor proxy for socioeconomic group there. At least for the males, it does work on the amount of pension. However, we are now asking schemes to submit postcodes to us when they send us data. So hopefully we will be able to spot these cases where we're actually getting someone with several different pensions, but all living in Kensington and Chelsea or St George's Hill, Weybridge, as opposed to St George's Hill High Street, which is another matter altogether. But yes, we will be trying to address that question in future. We also have a slight issue as to whether we use the whole postcode and get very granular results, or whether we use the first part of it and get rather more broad-ranging results. The experience that I have seen of using a much more broad-ranging, rather smooth approach is that you tend to lose all regional differentiation in that way, so the more granular approach probably is better.
Sorry, can I just understand that? Because when John had his slide about what you're going to do in the future, he talked about doing it by industrial groups, by industry and so on. Could you just say again what it is you're... So is this going to give you Because geography has, at least the urban myth is that the geography makes a big difference, but I didn't see geography as one of the differentiators. Could you just say again what it is you're going to use the postcode for, and if you're collecting all the postcodes, why aren't you going to do something geographical?
We have the data specification now includes postcode, whereas it didn't before, and clearly with the time lags that we have, that we've talked about earlier, it means we're not going to be able to get usable volumes of postcode data for 2 or 3 years at least. What the work we are doing that John was talking about is actually this year's work, so we're pretty much based on the data that we've got already, but we're hoping people will be able to provide us with postcode. We believe it's okay under data protection. And that we will be able to build up a substantial volume of data to enable us to do that in the future, but we're not going to be able to do it immediately.
All right, I suppose that, I mean, given what, I mean, we want to keep the discussion going on that particular issue, but I suppose given the lead time, as we've heard, before you've got sufficient data to be able to do things, this would be a good, to go back to my original question, what do people use these tables for? This would presumably be a good time for the audience to be indicating things that they would really like from this stuff, albeit that it might be 5 or 6 years before they get it. So presumably you're happy to take any comments or ideas that people have on that. Well, I'm interested to know from the audience, I still like to have some idea of what people actually do with whatever tables they have. Do you, as a group, ask for a straw poll if it's easier, but do people take the data, the mortality data, the deaths in the inter-evaluation period, plot them, and then look for a table that's a good fit? Is that what people, and so the more tables you have and the more opportunities you have to find one that fits, is that what people actually want out of this stuff? Or what else do you do with them?
I'll just add a comment to what I do, and this is clearly what I personally do rather than what the SAPS committee suggests you do, and that is it depends on the scheme I'm looking at. So for small schemes, what's happened in terms of mortality tells me something useful about why the funding position has moved to what it is now, but it doesn't tell me anything about the future. For middle-sized schemes, maybe sort of middle to large-sized schemes, the sort of total amounts of death might tell me something about the overall level of mortality, but it doesn't tell me anything about the shape of the mortality, whether it's particularly higher at younger ages or higher ages. And for my very larger schemes, it tells me something about the shape as well. So I guess I have a mixed bag of options that I take for looking at schemes data.
And so, if I can, for those small schemes or the medium schemes where there's probably not enough data in the scheme to do anything really fantastic, I mean, what are you looking for? Are you looking for actually some information about the kind of people that went into that particular table, because geographically, by industry, by whatever else, they seem like a pretty good match for the scheme that you've actually got, but which doesn't have enough data to really match something? Because we haven't heard much. We've heard a little bit about labelling, but we haven't heard an awful lot about any descriptors that the CMI might issue with these tables that might be helpful when an actuary is looking for the right table to say, well, I haven't got enough data in my scheme to really get a very good fit, but this appears to be a set of tables for a bunch of people who have an average pension of 10,000 a year, are predominantly from an industrial background or whatever else. Is that part of the plan, to give people those descriptors?
It's certainly the plan to, I mean, clearly there's a need for, when I'm using a table, I need to be able to correlate the risk factors that I can observe for the scheme and ideally measure rather than just have a sort of rough feel for, to some kind of measures in the data or in the tables that I'm comparing it to, the wider data or the tables I'm comparing it to. So certainly as a committee, what we, again, this is a personal comment, but what I would like to see us doing and what we've sought to do so far, but based on the data we have, is to break things down in a way that seems sensible. Now, clearly, if there are ways that people want data broken down, then we would be very keen to know how people would like data broken down, and then if we are able to break the existing data down in that way, we can do so. If we're not able to break the existing data down in that way, then we can consider obtaining data which can be broken down that way in the future. And the postcodes is one example of that, where clearly there's a large number of people who are in favour of either looking at geography or the more granular detail with some kind of mapping to group together similar small areas. So if there are other ways that people would like data broken down, we would be interested in your comments and suggestions.
So this is your chance to put in a wish list to the CMI, your flexible friend.
I'll come back again, if I may, David Wilkie. I'm not going to say what I would like quite, but I think that a little bit of discussion about this might be worth it. We know from other studies, population studies and mainly, that there are moderate regional differences throughout Britain, I'm guessing here, but I guess about plus 15% in the northwest, i.e. west of Scotland, and about minus 15% in the southeast, not sure if that's right. There's also probably bigger differences between what in Vera Carstairs' report on mortality in Scotland about 20 years ago, she called affluent areas and deprived areas, which were based on enumeration districts rather than postcodes, but you can use the granular postcode approach to produce a whole range of more deprived and more affluent areas. But different companies would have a wide mixture. Not all, very few pension schemes, I'd have thought, have all their members from affluent areas, and very few would have all their members from deprived areas, who, if they're sufficiently deprived, are the sort of people that are unemployed anyway and not perhaps in pension schemes. That's one of the problems of the severe areas of severe deprivation. Nevertheless, there are regional differences and there are industrial differences, and I would have thought that certain industries, heavy industries, coal, steel, that type of thing, they're declining, but there are plenty of pensioners around. My guess would be that they have poorish mortality. Local authority, a mixture of clerical but also everyday workers, but teacher scheme, which is not in this, of course, it's a national one, is pretty much teachers, and so they probably have relatively good mortality. That doesn't come into this investigation, so it's safer to talk about it. There's no reason, I think, why an actuary shouldn't tailor their consideration of what the right mortality to use for a particular valuation or particular estimate is on the characteristics of the scheme, so far as they can tell, and it's pretty much subjective a bit then as to whether it's a big national scheme which would have enough data, or a fairly small local scheme with a regional locality, but you would know something about the general social class of the staff in it. And that, I think, would help. It certainly helps you to know more about the differentials. If one only has the PMA OO tables, there's not much choice for actuaries to use but the PMA OO tables. And I did a little investigation last year for companies from the west of Scotland who wanted the rather small companies, but if we put them together, we got aggregate data that looked enough. Their main point was they knew the west of Scotland had poor mortality, presumably their schemes had, but their actuaries were still advising to use standard UK mortality. and I was able to show that the mortality was not terribly bad, but not as good as the OO tables. But it might well have been just much the same as the tables you've investigated, simply because the OO tables seem to be a rather select group, or come from a rather select group of those pension schemes still, group pension schemes still insured by life offices. So that there's knowing more about it, I think, helps, and therefore investigation into regional variation, into the granular postcode and stuff, and using, as was mentioned, the generalised linear models to look at amounts and postcode and stuff like that is a useful exercise, because it then helps actuaries to make up their minds what to do, even if there are far too many tables produced for everybody to use, or they look too complicated to use. You know which way to go. Incidentally, on the ratios, Mr. Acting President, if a simple ratio were correct, the lines would be parallel on the graphs. You can obviously see that because it's on a log scale. The lines in general are not parallel, as Nigel pointed out, and therefore a simple ratio doesn't work precisely. It might be a reasonable approximation, though, for annuities at age 65.
Just to follow on from David Wilkie's comments, I do advise a couple of schemes that are in the industrial sector in Western Scotland, so we have double up on these problems, and the FDs always insist on two things. One is they never award pay rises higher than RPI, and that all their employees are inveterate chain smokers and drink a bottle of whiskey every night. When I do analysis of surplus, I can usually disprove that they've strictly paid RPI pay rises, but the second one is more difficult to counter. And I suspect the heavy table being based on the 75% heaviest is not going to wash, and actually they're going to insist on it, you know, me doing some work to find out the 25% worse, if not the 10% worse for some of their workforces.
Stephen Richards, I'd just like to pick up on the subject of pension size versus postcode and just mention that the paper presented to the Institute sessional meeting on the 25th of this month addresses exactly that variety of different ways of allowing for socioeconomic variations in pension schemes and life office portfolios. The second point is regarding regional variations in mortality. In all the work that I have done, the regional variation is predominantly variation in socioeconomic group. Most recently, I took a very large portfolio of about 350,000 annuitants. It's a UK insurer, so they had very good UK-wide coverage, and there was no detectable or no statistically significant regional variations whatsoever after allowing for the postcode-driven lifestyle groups. That's using the full two-part postcode. So I would caution against doing anything on a regional basis, just using the first couple of letters of the postcode. It's very likely to lead you down the wrong alley.
So I understand that, Stephen. So the postcode, the granular postcode, is a means of identifying socioeconomic groups. But actually, once you've done that, they could be anywhere. And that's not, if I understand. So is that? I mean, if Stephen's point is correct, and that's what the study, the paper later this month is going to show. Is that something that the CMI study is going to be able to pick up, or is that a bridge too far for the CMI at this stage? And if it is something you want to do, do you need to ask for different data?
We will be picking that up as part of the ongoing investigation. I know some concern has been expressed that trustees will feel uncomfortable passing on full postcodes, because it will then be able to get pretty close to identifying individuals, which at the moment just doesn't happen at all. We do believe the data protection legislation permits the use of this data, but we would certainly aim to use it in that socioeconomic group way rather than using the regional variations, as Richard, as Stephen has said.
Presumably, if you get the same lawyer as managed to square it for Stephen, you'll be all right. Any last requests to the CMI for things that it would be good to have in the tables, albeit 5 or 6 years hence, or any other comments on what you've heard so far before I ask Nigel to wrap it all up?
Crawford Taylor. Just to add to that point, I think the correlation between the different effects, we've got males and females, age and postcode and the granular effect, but then do we have to then layer on pension amount, or does postcode pick that up as well? And it's knowing all the effects and the correlations and what become, because if postcode can pick up all of that, then do we need to look no any further?
Stephen Richard again. This is somewhat anticipating the paper that's going to be presented at the Institute, but in fact there appears to be an independent effects of both pension size and postcode. The models I was fitting suggested that in most circumstances postcode was a slightly better proxy for social class than pension size, but a combination of both pension size and postcode together was almost always much, much better than either one of them on their own. So I think in conclusion you need to do postcode based modelling and amounts based modelling together.
Okay, any more for any more? What? Nigel, would you like to close off then?
Okay. Well, thank you for the contributions. I think probably we need to go back to the genesis of the committee here. We were brought into being because people found that the existing standard tables did not fit the experience of large pension schemes. We've are now producing tables which we believe will be more appropriate for general application, although this is not to say that the existing standards are incorrect. I know from some work done on financial services sector that the 92 series, for example, was by no means such a bad fit for that particular grouping as applied to a number of the other schemes, where we found the 92 series particularly and the 00 series to some extent were completely the wrong shape. So we believe we have got some tables here which will be useful to scheme actuaries in valuing their liabilities, because we are sampling from a different population. We only have to look at the relative volumes of male and female data to see that the CMI's data is relatively thin in female data. We have 8 times the female data and 4 times the male data. So we think there are very distinct different populations here which we hope will be useful to scheme actuaries. Whether 24 tables is useful to scheme actuaries is still slightly open to doubt. I am concerned that scheme actuaries will say, I don't know which to use, therefore I'll just use what I did last time. But I think we do need to get the information out there. We think it will be valuable. I take David's point, which I think is reflective of opinion generally, that There is certainly no harm in publishing lots of tables, particularly as we've already done the graduations for them. So we're minded to keep that going. We will look at the question of extension to other ages. And I think, other than trying to dream up another name for these series, so something that's not date driven, but without appearing to pander to the marketing people out there, we'll see if we can come up with something better. But it looks as though we may have to do one more consultation on different banding effects, because that was a very popular choice at, down south. But there'll be one more chance to write in before we put these tables out to the profession for adoption, I think is the correct term. So thank you for your contribution to the debate, and we will take it into account when we finish our work.
Sorry, Nigel, can I just, I mean, you may have said it, I missed it, but when you collect the consultation, but when, what's the, when will the profession next hear something from you on this?
In the absence of any further graduations, the idea was that we would finish at the end of February on the consultation, prepare tables by the end of March, which would be available for the profession to adopt in April. If we need to push out another set of tables, that'll be knocked backwards by about a month to 6 weeks. But we're very keen to get it done before the summer, otherwise everyone will have forgotten why we've done it in the first place.
Thank you. It's a characteristic of actuaries that they always want to see the glass half empty rather than half full. And there is a risk that just because we could all see lots more that Nigel's group could do, that we think that in some way, that's not a valuable contribution. But even if you just think about almost the very first slide that showed the amount of data that this group have collected compared with that which for decades we seem to be perfectly happy to work off, even though it was a tiny amount of data from a completely different population. It's a measure of how valuable and how much interest there is in this work. So my thanks on your behalf to Nigel, to Andrew, and to John, and ask you to throw your appreciation to them in the normal way. And may I close by reminding you that the next sessional meeting, which is not entirely unrelated to this, is on Monday, the 18th of February at the Merchant's House in Glasgow, when the topic will be annuity bulk buyout market rates. And the meeting will take the form of a panel discussion led by Cliff Speed, who is from Paternoster and therefore is deeply involved in that stuff.